Hello and welcome. My name is Claudia Zotzmann-Koch and I'm really excited that you are listening to one of my shows. This episode is going out to the Vienna Writers Podcast and the Diner Podcast at the same time. Most of my episodes are normally in German, but this one is an English one. Since it's an interview with Cory Doctorow on the book that he co-wrote with Rebecca Giblin. It's called Choke Point Capitalism, and the two authors argue that we're in a new era of choke point capitalism with exploitative businesses creating insurmountable barriers to competition that enable them to capture values that should rightfully go to others, mainly creatives, I should add. We already recorded this interview on July 26, 2023. So here's Cory Doctorow about how those business models work, how they deprive us creatives from getting paid fairly, and what we can actually do. So welcome to the Vienna Writers Podcast and also the Diner Podcast, Cory Doctorow. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, and you?
Yeah, very well.
Okay, so we're meeting here on the internet. I'm in Vienna. It's quite late here, and you are somewhere in the Pacific time zone, so it's in the mid of the day for you. And we're here to talk about one of your latest books that you wrote with Rebecca Giblin, Choke Point Capitalism.
That's right. And, yeah.
Yes, and I'm very excited to talk to you about it. You're an author and an activist for EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation. You have expertise so in creative work, also the current creative industry, and also in digital rights and what we all can do to change the world for the better. Maybe the first question, how did you get there?
Well, you know, on the one hand, it's a very circuitous and contingent route. But on the other hand, in retrospect, it seems almost inevitable. I was raised by high tech leftist activists. So here I am. My father's a computer scientist. My mom is an early childhood educator who from a very early stage was interested in and really pioneering ways of using digital tools to teach young children. Both of them are leftist organizers involved in abortion rights, anti-nuclear armament, socialist politics, labor politics, and so on. And so it seemed inevitable that those things would come together. And then, you know, both my parents, but especially my father, are really interested in science fiction. And when I was young, my dad and I used to watch Doctor Who together on the nights that my mom was at teacher's college. And our Doctor Who on our public television was introduced every week by a writer called Judith Merrill. And Judy was a great editor and critic and writer who came from America but went into exile in Canada after the Chicago police riots in 1968. And she brought her personal library with her. She had been married to Frederick Pohl, and so she brought their books and donated them to the Toronto Public Library System, and they formed the nucleus of a library that was then called the Spaced Out Library and is now named for her as the Merrill Collection. And when I was about 10 years old, I took a school trip to her library, and she was the writer in residence. And she said, you know, if any of you write a story, you can just bring it down to my library and I will help you make it better. So this is, you know, 10-year-old me being offered critiquing sessions by Judith Merrill. So I started bringing her manuscripts, and she would put writers who were promising together in workshops. So as a teenager, I ended up in a workshop with other writers. She had also founded the writing workshop at the high school that I went to many years before. I didn't even know this until long after, but she had done a writer in the schools grant and gone and founded this writer's workshop. And that workshop was so good, I actually stayed in school for an extra 3 years after I could have graduated just to stay in that workshop, and took 7 years to get into my 4-year high school. She convinced a local fan to start what is now the oldest science fiction bookstore in the world. It was staffed by writers. When I was, again, 10 or 11 years old, we took a school trip there, and a writer behind the counter named Tanya Huff, who had just sold her first short story, sold me the first book that I ever bought with my own money, a science fiction novel called Little Fuzzy by H. Beam Piper. And then when she quit to write full time 8 years later, I got her job. So, you know, Judith Merrill had created this thing that was basically a formal apprenticeship for science fiction writers, you know, without really meaning to, just because that was the way that she operated. And I went through that program while being steeped in radical politics. And the two came together to make me the person I am today.
Sounds, as you said, quite inevitable.
Yeah.
Wonderful. In the beginning, or as I understood it from the outside and very much later than you just started, but you self-published most of your works under Creative Commons licenses for decades, I think, before you went for traditional publishing and a big publishing. No,
absolutely not. No, 100% wrong. Sorry. I started selling stories to magazines when I was 17. And then I sold my first novel to Macmillan, which is the largest science fiction publisher in the world. They're I sold it to the Tor imprint. They're part of the Von Holtzbrinck empire. My first novel with them, Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom in 2003, was the first book ever released under a Creative Commons license, and it was published by a big mainstream publisher. And all of my books, except for one short story collection, were published by large mainstream publishers. And until 2017, Tor was happy to have me continue do Creative Commons releases. Unfortunately, they afterwards told me to stop. I wish they'd let me continue. I think it's hurt my sales. But I did release many novels irrevocably under Creative Commons licenses, and they continue to circulate.
Okay, I see my mistake here, because in the German-speaking book market, it's really difficult to get publishers to make Creative Commons contents into works they publish.
Well, it's impossible in the English market now too, for whatever it's worth. But, you know, I had a bold editor and a publisher that stood behind me, at least at the start with this experiment. But, you know, my publisher is owned by a German, right? It's owned by Stefan von Holtzbrinck. So, you know, it was German.
Okay, because I only know one author in Germany who made it in the last 5 years to get a Creative Commons work in a publishing house, and it was quite a struggle. Greetings go out to Uwe Dobermann.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a struggle then too, but I had an editor who was very technologically smart. He continues to be my editor, Patrick Nielsen Hayden. We met on a BBS in the 1980s when I was a teenager. You know, he ran his own Linux boxes with his own WordPress installations, and he wrote plugins for them, and, you know, was a very digitally oriented fella. And so for him, it seemed like a natural experiment to try.
Cool. We're on the path into the direction of that choke point capitalism. So how did we end up with big tech companies ruling also the creative markets, not only text-based for authors and publishers, but also for music, also for pictures. So how did we get from experimental stuff and Creative Commons publishing to where we are now?
Yeah. Well, and I would make a small alteration to that, because I don't think that it's just big tech that's doing it. I think that it's fairer to say that while once it was the case that the large entertainment companies were so consolidated that they were able to abuse their artists with impunity, and then there was an interval where the tech companies came in, and in order to compete with the entertainment companies, they offered the creators a better deal, that today tech and entertainment both offer very bad deals to creators, and they're now largely indistinguishable from each other. So the question that Rebecca and I, my co-author and I, set out to answer when we started writing this book is, how is it that over 40 years all over the world, we've expanded copyright? Now copyright lasts longer. It covers more kinds of works. It restricts a wide variety of activities. It has stiffer penalties, and it's easier to prove infringement and get those penalties. and that this has resulted in the explosive growth of the profits of entertainment companies, but the share of income going to creators has fallen. Both as a proportion of the money that the corporation brings in and just in terms of how many dollars they get every month to buy groceries and feed their kids. And the answer we came up with is that when there's only five giant publishers and four giant studios and three giant record labels and two companies that do all the ad tech and two companies that do all the apps and one company that does all the ebooks and audiobooks, that in that marketplace, giving a creator more copyright to go and bargain with capital with is like giving a bullied kid extra lunch money. There isn't an amount of lunch money you can give your bullied kid that will satisfy the bullies. And the more money you give your kid, the more money the bullies end up getting. And if you give them enough money, they'll eventually figure out how to start running a campaign saying, you know, somebody think of the hungry school children and give them more lunch money. They deserve it. And you know, that's the place that we've got to now, where the entertainment industries have grown so strong by transferring the increasingly expansive copyrights that we give to creators to themselves. And that's true, whether it's an entertainment company that started as a tech company or a tech company that started as an entertainment company, that it's become much harder for creators to bargain. And, you know, today with the actors and the writers on strike, I think it's the problem of bargaining power versus copyright is quite obvious to a lot of us.
And you're saying a very current thing that's happening with the writer's strike and author strike in the US. And this is something that also made it into the German speaking media. So there's something actually happening because in the US, writers are also organized. How did you get there? Because in the German-speaking area of the world, it seems quite difficult to get authors organized in such a way that they actually go and strike.
Well, it has to be said that it's only a small group of all the people who call themselves writers who are in a union. The unions that represent creative workers in the United States are all artifacts of the New Deal. So this was the Franklin Delano Roosevelt post-depression economic program that saw a great surge of labor rights for all kinds of creative workers. And one of the things that was characteristic of that program was that creators were given the power to bargain sectorally, which I think is quite common in Germany, but is almost unheard of in American labor. And really, like, they're the last big sectoral bargaining industry is the film industry. And what sectoral bargaining means is that instead of bargaining with a company, you bargain with all of the companies. So when the writers strike a deal, it's a deal that applies to every single studio, not just one studio that they've gone out on strike against. And the writers have always been the most radical of the entertainment industry unions since the very start. And, you know, it would be very hard to do today to organize another union like this that was empowered to sectorally bargain because of the changes in labor law. But one of the things that I'm very heartened by is the degree to which workers are coming to expect that they should be allowed to sectorally bargain, that it's unfair that you have to bargain one company at a time. And I know that in Germany, the Steelworkers Union has organized YouTubers, which is quite exciting. Not writers, but performers, and another very atomized group of performers, right, who as workers tend to see themselves as individuals without a lot of collective cohesion. You know, one of the things that a focus on copyright for creative livings does is it invites us to conceive of ourselves not as creative workers, but as, I call them, LLCs with MFAs, you know, limited liability companies with a Master of Fine Arts degree, right? Where you're a small business person and they're a large business and you are negotiating business to business. And in those business to business negotiations, you're always going to get crushed, right? And it's only when you start thinking of yourself as a worker that you can start understanding that you need to do things that enhance your bargaining power and are not just about having more to bargain with, right? So copyright is more things that you can bargain away, but it doesn't make it easier for you to bargain for a good deal. If you're going to be an empowered creative worker, you need to have more bargaining power, not just more bargaining material.
The organization in Germany, the Verdi, that you mentioned, it also has a section for writers, the VS. So people who are writing can become a member there, but it seems to take a lot of time to do this. I already signed up in May, in the beginning of May, so I'm still hoping for a letter from the VS to become a member.
Well, good luck with it. I mean, they might be slow or inefficient, or they might be a bad union, and there are bad unions. But it's important to note that, like, the place that bad unions come from is not workers, but bosses. No worker wants a bad union, but every boss wants a bad union. And so the force that drives unions to be corrupt and ineffective is capital, not labor, because capital likes a union boss who you can bribe to feather his own nest at the expense of workers. Workers don't like that for obvious reasons. So, you know, maybe they're just a union that is experiencing too much growth or has gotten in out of their head, or they lack some administrative competence, in which case, you know, I think it's worth, you know, when and if you end up a member, trying to figure out how to improve their administrative capability. But, you know, even more important is to, if it turns out that they're corrupt, is to try to figure out how to make them a better union, right? Is to fight for that. Because, you know, you're not going to be able to make it on your own, but you can improve your union and make them better.
That would be also a good idea, probably, for all the writers or other creative organizations, because lots of them, or like the VG Wort, for example, they're simultaneously the lobby organization for the authors and for the publishers. We all see where this is going.
Yeah, that's been a huge problem in copyright policy more broadly, is that publishers convinced a lot of creators that they have coterminal interests, that the interests of creators and the interests of their bosses are the same. And it's pretty clearly not the case. Someone on Twitter very cleverly yesterday said, the same companies that spent 20 years telling us that it was immoral to copy a DVD now want to copy a whole actor. And, you know, it's very true, right? It's apparently copying a DVD is wrong, but copying a person isn't. And you know, I think that it's very clear that the interests of capital and the interests of labor diverge. But I also want to talk about some of the other stuff that's in this book and kind of how we structured it. So the first half of the book, it's about six chapters, delve into the underlying kind of accounting fraud and scams that are used to steal from creators, how that excessive bargaining power is used to shift money from the labor force to the shareholders of the companies that we work for. And it's very enraging, you know, because these are really shockingly bald frauds that are, you know, manifestly unfair. And a lot of people tell us that, you know, as they get to the halfway point of the book, they start to hear like an alarming high-pitched noise that's like an incipient rage aneurysm from reading all this enraging stuff. But the second half of the book is all extremely detailed plans for doing something about it. And not for like individuals to do something about it by like shopping better or bargaining better individually, but systemic things that we can demand when the crisis comes. So, you know, one of the great archdukes of our misery today is a guy named Milton Friedman. And he was kind of the American Renfield to the Austrians, von Mises and von Hayek. And he ran the University of Chicago School of Economics, which is where we get Reaganism and Thatcherism and in Canada, Mulroneyism and so on. And for many years, he was agitating for a rollback to the post-war policies that were so popular, the policies that let everyday workers go to university, let them get pensions, let them get well taken care of and so on. People would say to him, you know, like, Milton, people like these things. How are you going to convince them to give up these things that they depend on? And he would say, well, you know, whenever there is a crisis whatever ideas are lying around can move from the periphery to the center very quickly. People will reach to new ideas, the ideas that they've been hearing about for years, but that didn't seem to have a place. And he was right. I mean, he was wrong about everything else, but he was right about that. And the point of this book is to create some new ideas lying around, because every time we have a crisis, and we've had so many crises in the arts and technology and new media distribution, we just end up doing the same thing we did last time, but harder. So, you know, in 2019, the European Union created the Filternet Directive, the Digital Single Markets Directive, that requires every online service provider to have a copyright filter that scans everything that a user posts, every word we say, everything we stream, every recording we upload, and scans it to see whether it thinks it might infringe copyright and blocks it if it does. And this is just terrible. It's not going to work. It's going to cost hundreds of millions of dollars, which means that you won't get small companies entering the market or cooperatives run by artists themselves. And it's going to have all kinds of collateral damage for free speech. But the reason we got there is because there was a real crisis in artists' incomes, and no one had a good idea apart from the same thing we've done every other time, which was just like more copyright. You know, do the same thing as last time, but harder. And so artist groups, they threw their weight behind this policy and it passed. So the point here is to have these well-developed technical proposals for better things we can do the next time someone identifies a real problem and demands that something must be done. So to give you a brief example of one of those proposals, in the creative arts, if you are entitled to a royalty for your work, and you audit your royalty statement to find out whether or not you've been fairly compensated, it is very often the case that you will find an error in that royalty statement. And that error is nearly always in the favor of the label or the studio or the publisher and not the creative worker. We cite in the book a company here in Los Angeles that has done tens of thousands of record label audits over decades. And in all of these audits they've done, only on one occasion did they find an error that was in the favor of the artist. Every other time, the error was in the favor of the label. I can't understand how this is possible. It seems statistically very unlikely, and my heart goes out to those accountants who must struggle under some very difficult conditions. But, you know, what's even more interesting is what happens when you identify these errors. If you find that your publisher, your label, or your studio has stolen from you, and you demand that they pay you the money that they owe you, they'll sort of pat you on the head and say, oh, you creators, you're adorable, but you don't know how to do math. And you think that we owe you money, but we don't. And of course, you can't afford to sue us because we're very big and powerful. So we'll tell you what, since we're such nice guys, we'll pay you half of what you think we owe you. And all you have to do is sign this non-disclosure agreement, which prohibits you from telling other creative workers we're stealing from that we're stealing from them too, and where to find the money. Now, all of these non-disclosure agreements are settled in one of four states because there's so much market concentration in the arts that if you're signing a non-disclosure agreement with an artistic organization, it's almost certainly in California or New York or Washington State because Amazon and the studios, game studios are in Seattle, or in Tennessee because Nashville is there. And state law is what governs contracts in the United States. And state law is much easier to change than federal law or regulation. So if we could amend one or more of those state contract laws to say that a non-disclosure can't be enforced when it relates to a material omission or misstatement that is detrimental to the interests of someone who is owed royalties, then at the stroke of that pen, we would put more money into the pockets of more artists than all of the copyright term extensions of the last 40 years combined. Right. And so the next time there's a giant scandal about royalties, rather than saying, oh, well, let's make more copyright, we could say, let's make royalties easier to secure from companies by banning them from gagging the people who catch them stealing their royalties. Right. And that would be a much better solution. And we go through about a half a dozen of these, not with the idea that you personally, after reading this book, are going to be able to, you know, call up your member of Congress or your parliamentarian and convince them to pass this. But rather, the next time there is a big scandal going on and the people around you are saying we should do something about this and you agree with them, that you can make and we can make part of this debate an understanding of where the money is leaking out of the system and how to plug that leak.
And this is something that you're actually working on in the US. So you're already trying that?
No, but I mean, it's bound to come up, right? Because we keep having these incredible crises, right? So like, it, you know, there is so much theft from artists through their royalties. And, you know, there was a scandal like this a couple of years ago. There's a writer named Alan Dean Foster, who's a very beloved science fiction writer. And one of his best known works was the novelization for Star Wars, which sounds like maybe it's a cheap piece of work. You know, movie novelizations are usually written very quickly and they're often not very good. But he wrote this book before Star Wars came out. And this book gave George Lucas the missing parts that he needed. So the movie actually changed based on what Foster put in his book. And for years and years, he was paid a royalty for this book because that was his deal with the publisher. And when Disney bought Lucasfilm, they argued that although they had acquired Lucasfilm's assets, including the right to publish Alan Dean Foster's books, they had not acquired their liabilities, which is to say the need to publish Alan, to pay Alan Dean Foster a royalty. And so Foster went after them, right? He spent months and years trying to get them to pay him. His agent was threatening them and so on. And they refused to speak with him except under non-disclosure, which is why he eventually went public. But if, you know, now that there's a lot of outrage about this and he's finally gotten paid, he's not the only one that was getting ripped off that way. And there are lots of other artists who are getting ripped off that way. One of the things that we should have understood then when there was a movement underway among artists and creators who cared about them was that part of the problem here was the non-disclosure itself, right? It wasn't just that there was a problem with the theft, but there was also a problem that it is legal to steal from someone. And then when they finally force you to pay them, to bind them to silence so they're not allowed to tell the other people you're stealing from. And that was a thing that we could have added to our demands if it had been in the kind of air when we were, for the last 3 years since the Foster scandal broke, then we would have had, as the strike came along, we would have had creative workers thinking naturally about one of their demands being an end to non-disclosure in these settlements as well. So, you know, it's not too late because unfortunately there's going to be more crises in the years to come because they're still stealing from creators. They're still using non-disclosure to try and stop creators from talking about it when they catch them at it. And if we talk about this now, then the next time this comes up, we can make non-disclosure part of the bargaining.
So reading contracts is actually a superpower, and making new contracts seems to be something that we all have to learn and to organize ourselves to make politicians on state level or also then on global level, hopefully, at some point, something, that's getting better for everyone then.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, if you're a European whose royalties have been stolen by an American company, this law would protect you too, because it's in California that they would ask you for a non-disclosure, not in, you know, Germany or Austria or France. And so this is a way to make every artist in the world richer.
So this would be something for the indies here in Europe who have probably contracts with American publishing houses to get public with those things,
Yeah. Or if, you know, if you're a musician who signed a deal with an American record label, or if you're a screenwriter who's got a deal with an American studio, or if you're a songwriter, you know, all of those things are things that you can that you would benefit from having a ban on non-disclosure, not merely because this would mean that if you ever caught them stealing your royalties, you wouldn't be able, they wouldn't be able to swear you to silence, but because you will find out that people are stealing your royalties and where to look for them, because other creators who are in the same boat as you, who catch them at it, can go public when they catch them. And so you're going to benefit from opening up, you know, your web browser one day and seeing an email from your professional association or seeing a news article that says, hey, this is how Warner Music steals from its artists. And here's what the accounting scam looks like. And you can say, oh, well, I'm signed to Warner Music. I bet they're stealing from me that way, too. And you can go back and look at your own royalty statements that way. Right. So this is of benefit to every artist if we can get rid of these non-disclosure requirements.
And something that we in Europe still have to learn is to just stand up and fight for our rights and not be just so thankful that some publishing house just took us in. So this is something that we have to learn.
And part of the point here is that as an individual creator, you have very little power to negotiate those deals, right? They are, these are things that either you need a union to say no artist is allowed to sign this deal, or which comes out of a collective bargaining program, a sectoral bargaining program, or you need a law that says even if you sign a deal like this, it can't be enforced because these are not enforceable clauses. They're what a contract lawyer would call unconscionable clauses, right? They offend the conscience.
Oh dear. Okay, lots to do. You have lots more in the book. Would you like to talk about the other parts inside?
So the first half of the book is as I said, understanding how the scams work, and the second half of the book is understanding what to do about it. So let me think of a good scam from the book. I talked about Alan Dean Foster and Disney saying that they don't owe him royalties. Oh, we could talk about Audible. That's a good one. Mm-hmm. So Audible is part of Amazon. They're the audiobook monopolist part of Amazon. They control more than 90% of the audiobook market. And Audible has this self-serve marketplace called ACX, where if you're an audiobook creator, you can upload your own audiobook and they'll sell it on Audible for you. And there are far more ACX creators than there are professional, studio and label signed creators on the platform, as you might imagine. And those creators noticed that their royalties were going down and down and down. Now, one of the things that Amazon is really oriented around as a business is figuring out how to lock customers in. Because once a customer is locked into Amazon, then the business users, so publishers, independent creators, sellers in Amazon's marketplace, they have to come and sell on Amazon. If all of your customers are locked into Amazon, then that's where you have to be too. And you have to take whatever terms Amazon demands of you. So one of the ways that Amazon does this is by getting users to take out subscriptions instead of buying things one at a time. And so with Audible, the dominant way of buying an Audible book is through a monthly subscription price that entitles you to a new book every month. And so Audible really wants to make that subscription as valuable as possible. And so what it did was it went to the customers, the subscribers, and it said, anytime you'd like, no questions asked, you can return any audiobook that you've bought, even if you've listened to it three times over, even if you've had it for 6 months. And with no questions asked, we'll give you a refund of your credit and you can get another book. Now, that makes that subscription much more valuable. But what they didn't tell anyone, not those subscribers and not the artists who were uploading their books to ACX after financing them themselves, who were required to give Amazon 7 years of exclusivity as the only seller for their books, was that whenever a listener returned a book, Amazon took back the royalty from the creator. And the way the creators were kept in the dark about this is that Amazon didn't show them the returns and the sales. They just gave them a single number. Like this week, you sold 8 books. But maybe you sold 28 books and Amazon convinced your listeners, 20 of them, to return their books. Amazon simply records that as a net sale of 8 books and doesn't tell you what your returns are. And so then Amazon had a glitch and they sent out 3 weeks worth of returns all at once. And all of a sudden, a bunch of creators were like, wait a second, how did I sell minus 25 books this week? And that's what tipped them off. And there was Amazon Audible writer in Perth, Australia, who started to dig into this. Her name is Susan May. And then another Amazon audiobook creator in the UK, who's a retired forensic accountant, who now writes thrillers about forensic accountants, started to look into it. And they figured out what was going on and estimated that more than $100 million had been stolen from Amazon creators with this and other forms of funny accounting. Now, this was only possible because Amazon wasn't forced to make a full accounting of how it calculated your royalties. In the Digital Single Markets Directive of 2019, that same directive that has the terrible copyright filter rule, there's also a rule that requires everyone who pays a royalty to describe the royalty calculations, to disclose the royalty calculations and the underlying data to everyone who has paid a royalty. This is a really powerful remedy, right? It doesn't solve the whole problem, but one of the reasons that Amazon was able to steal with impunity from its creators for so long was because the creators didn't know they were being stolen from, right? So once you know you're being stolen from, then you can make a noise about it, right? Then you can point to the unfair business practice. Then you can convince lawmakers to do something about it. Then you can sue. Then you can reach out to your audience. Then you can form a union. All of those things arise out of understanding the shape of the scam.
Yeah. And I think this is something, this power to do that, I think this is something we have also to learn to use it, to get into that power and demand the rights that we have.
Right. Well, and in Europe, you know, thanks to the Digital Single Markets Directive, you will have that power guaranteed in statute. So you will be able to force your creative employer to tell you how they calculated your royalties. And that goes even if they're in America.
Mm. Which is great. So one step at a time. Do you see any further creative ways to get back or reclaim our occupational dignity as creatives? Because lots of people, also publishing houses, probably also music labels, I haven't worked with them personally, so I don't know them, but they often have this attitude like, hey, you're doing that because you're a creative, you have fun doing that. So this is like, we pay you just a bit for your hobby. And this is just not a real occupation, but actually it is for lots of us.
Yeah, I'm just looking up the name of the woman who's, I'm about to cite her work, and I always forget her name. One second. So the term here is vocational awe, A-W-E, and it comes from a woman called Fobazi Attar. And Attar describes, she's a librarian, and she says that people who work in vocations that give them a sense of intrinsic satisfaction and like they're doing good for the world are really easily exploited, because you can exploit that sense of satisfaction to do exactly as you described, right? To make people feel grateful that they're getting a check at all. And in one of his last books, David Graeber in Bullshit Jobs talks about how a lot of people treat anyone who's got a job that doesn't make them dead inside as if they shouldn't be asking for a fair wage as well. You know, you're a teacher, you get to do things for the good of your students. Why do you also want a living wage, right? Don't you do it just for the satisfaction? You know, whereas I, a creator, you know, a minor functionary at a finance firm who exists solely to be like a dotted line on an org chart to make some sociopath feel more important. You know, if you didn't pay me $500,000 a year, I wouldn't show up for work. But, you know, you get to take care of little kids or write books or whatever. Why should you get paid a living wage? You've got just the satisfaction of doing the job itself. So I think that that's definitely an issue that arises in the creative arts. You know, one of the more creative solutions that there is to this problem is something called transfer of termination. Or termination or transfer, rather. So in the 1976 Copyright Act in the United States, there was originally a proposal that said that after 25 years, once you've signed a contract transferring your copyright as a creator to any kind of company, 25 years later, automatically, it goes back to you. It doesn't matter if the contract says that you're signing it away for the full term of copyright. That goes back to you after 25 years. And you can't contract out of it. And that termination right was watered down substantially. It got extended to 35 years. And they created a big paperwork burden for it. So you have to file a lot of paperwork to get your copyrights back. But nevertheless, it's turned out to be a really powerful way to get a lot of artists paid. Because while you don't have a lot of bargaining power before your book or your music or your movie has come out, if it's a proven success, if after 35 years, we could even make it shorter, we can make it 15 years, if it's still making money, well, then you can go to your publisher, your label, or your studio and say, either you pay me again, you know, we reopen the bargaining and you pay me a fair royalty, or I just get this book back. I mean, Alan Dean Foster, when Disney was stealing from him over his royalties, could have just said, great, I'm terminating the transfer, I get this book back. And in fact, that's what's happening with Marvel. All of the creators who made work for Marvel, including Stan Lee, who was the founder of Marvel, they are now eligible to reclaim their characters. And they are all suing to get, including Stan Lee's estate, to get all the Marvel characters back from Disney, to terminate those transfers and give them back to themselves. And so most countries do not have a copyright termination in their copyright law. It's something that Europe could really use. Ironically, whenever other countries try to pass a termination rule, the American trade representative shows up and says, oh, no, this is a very bad idea, even though America does have one and it's served America very well. So, you know, that's one of the more creative ways that we can amend the way that the law works in order to ensure that creators get a bigger slice of the pie. And, you know, one of the reasons that we got into this problem in the first place is we adopted neoliberal economics. And one of the doctrines of neoliberal economics is that we should allow companies to merge, even if that will create a monopoly, because monopolies are considered to be intrinsically efficient, that they can use the fact that they've got everything under one roof to realize all these efficiencies that they would otherwise not be able to find if they had to engage in what they call wasteful competition. And, you know, that makes things very bad for artists. But another element of neoliberalism that makes things bad for artists is the idea that creators should think of themselves as business people bargaining as individuals instead of as a collective, bargaining as a collective who needs systemic solutions. And so one of the things we're at great pains to do in the book is to try and demonstrate how these are systemic problems without individual solutions, and how they go further than the arts, how these are the same problems that all kinds of workers are facing, even if there are slightly different contours for the arts.
Hmm. So all in all, everything comes down to one, trickle-down economics doesn't work, so it's more like slurp-up economics, that
very
everything
true.
Yeah, goes up to the publishing houses and so on. We as creatives just have to organize, right?
Yes, yeah, 100%. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, so do you see any creative way in creative activism to get those things running, or is it the real, old new thing with organizations?
Start by trying to take over, you know, join your union. If your union sucks, make it better. That's the first thing to do. And if there isn't a union, see about starting one. But there is almost always a union that a creator can join. You know, we talked about that before, that there's a union, but it's not very strong. Make the union better, right? That is like, it is only through collective action. And once the union is formed, even if the union has problems, you're still more than halfway there, right? Much easier to reform a bad union than to start a new union from scratch. And always remember, right, the reason that your boss... the reason that you have a bad union is because your boss likes it, not because the workers like it. Workers don't like bad unions.
Live as if your boss doesn't like it.
That's right.
Okay. Is there any one more thing that creatives out there should know?
No, I think that's a good. I think that's a good background right there. I think that's that covers a lot of ground.
Okay, so. Your book with Rebecca Giblin, Choke Point Capitalism, the book that everyone should read and should understand how that market actually works and then do something about it.
Very good. Well, thank you very much. It's been really a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you for taking the time. And let's bring all those new ideas, not only lying around, but into the world, to the creatives. Thank you, Cory Doctorow.
Thank you very much. Yeah, it was nice talking to you.
Nice talking to you. Thanks.
Yeah, so this is it for today. For a whole lot more details and examples, read Choke Point Capitalism. I can really recommend the book. There's also an audio recording of Cory's talk at the Elevate Festival this year in Graz, in the feed of the Vienna Writers podcast, and also as bonus episode in the Diner podcast feed too. Thanks a lot for the permission to the Elevate Festival team for that. Cory's new book is also just out, The Internet Con, How to Seize the Means of Computation. A big tech disassembly manual presenting a theory of internet entitification and a way to throw it into reverse, creating a new good internet that is the worthy successor of the old good internet, so that the internet of today is thrown on the scrap heap of history as an unfortunate transitional stage between the two. You can find all the links in the show notes. Thanks again, Cory Doctorow, and a big thanks to you for listening. Okay, let's go get organized and work together that we can have a great internet again. Have a great day. Yours, Claudia.